This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
When we talk about global literature, we should start from two points. One is the consequence of globalization in culture. The other one is the conjecture of Weltliteratur coined by Goethe. So as for the first one, yes, I think globalization did not, come up suddenly in the 1980s. It has a long history. If we, follow what Marx and Engels talked about in Communist Manifesto, the symbol of globalization coming, yes, into the current world should date back, yes, to 1492, when Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas. Expansion started from Europe to the Americas as well as to the whole world. Of course, after the detailed description of how capitalist expansion, both economically and financially, Marx and Engels summed up, numerous national literatures will arise a kind of world literature. So actually, Marx and Engels, for the first time, yes, associate world literature is with the consequence of globalization in culture. But when we talk about globalization in culture, yes, we should not forget that it was Goethe, yes, who, in his talk with Ekman in 1827, in which he put forward his conjecture of Weltliteratur. As far as we know, Goethe was very gifted in foreign languages. He altogether, when he was young, he already learned to use seven languages to create literary works, including theater, poetry, and prose, and even short stories. But unfortunately, he did not understand any Asian languages. Even so, he was very interested in Asian and Oriental literature. At first, when he was young, he was interested in Perse and read some Persian literary works. And later, he became interested in Chinese and Indian literary works. At that time, not many Chinese literary works were translated into German. Fortunately, Goethe was very good at English and French, through which he got hold of access, yes, to some Chinese literary works, such as Hao Qiu Zhuan, Yu Jiao Li, and so much and so forth. After reading these Chinese literary works, he was inspired and stimulated to find that poetry from different countries should have the common property. And then he further went on. Nowadays, national literature is rather unmeaningful. The epoch of world literature is just at hand. So he finally called on people to quicken the step of world literature in his own way. So I should say, in this way, we could associate global culture and world literature. And in this way, we could also conclude that the term global literature is possible. It is an enlarged form of elite literary production, translation, and circulation. And when we talk about global literature, we should also be inspired by what Marx and Engels used the term world literature, which to them is an enlarged, way of cosmopolitan, bourgeois literary and intellectual production and circulation. So in this way, we should say there is a possibility to talk about global literature. On the other hand, you know, people might be puzzled, you know, because...
Yeah, I'm puzzled about the sense in which so much of globalization and certainly the commercial elements in modern China would seem to indicate more a direction that Marx and Engels would have decried. So how do you accommodate current tendencies in Chinese culture, and particularly some popular literature, some Chinese popular literature, and the commercial culture with the notion of global literature?
Yes, I think, you know, when we talk about global literature, we do not mention those elite literary works, you know, produced by Shakespeare, Jane Austen, so much and so forth. We also include such popularized literary works, by even non-elite writers. And also, we could also find in the age of globalization, serious literature and or elite literature were severely challenged by popular culture and even consumer culture. People nowadays seldom read novels such as Anna Karenina and also Resurrection, James Joyce's Ulysses, although they know the names of these authors and their works. People would rather spend much time to beautify their own life in an aesthetic way. Even we could find a lot of magazines, very well designed magazines, yes, in the book market, even in the bookstores at the airport, so much and so forth. On the other hand, we could also find some elite literary studies disciplines, such as comparative literature, was also impacted by cultural studies. So that's why some people complain that the rise of cultural studies in China has tolled the bell for serious literary studies, especially comparative literature in the Eurocentric sense. But on the other hand, we could also find since world literature was the early stage of comparative literature, the communist stage of comparative literature should also be world literature. But here we could already find there are two kinds of world literatures. One is world literature in general from a theoretical point of view. The other one is world literatures in particular from the national literature point of view. So in this way, yes, we could find world literature is not, the narrowing of literature, but enlarging of literature, its production, translation, and the circulation. Mm. Yeah.
Yes, if I can interject something, it reminds me of the position taken by a French sinologist. I don't know whether you heard his name, Etiamble, who. Yeah. Had this idea of a really comparative literature, world literature and comparative literature, was very important in France in the, I would say, 50s and 60s, because he insisted that literati, intellectuals, should know, say, Confucius, yeah, as well as Socrates. But every time you suggest this kind of opening, to people who are not sinologists, there is generally a resistance, as if they feel that even if they have the translations, they don't understand the meaning. What would you say to them? Do you have do you agree with Etienne's idea of, let's say, the man of the new enlightenment will be somebody who can see side by side Plato, Confucius, Lao Tzu, and so on? Not only all the literary texts, but also the philosophical foundations.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
It's absolutely significant view is to mention, Etienne, who is one of my favorite French comparatists, who helped promote Chinese literature in the French-speaking world, and who even addressed the International Triennial Congress of the International Comparative Literature, which was held in 1985 in Paris. In the concluding remark, he said one of the very important things for comparative literature now is the rise of comparative literature in China. And he even used the term Renaissance de la littérature comparée en Chine. So I'm sure that along with such insightful, ideas put forward by Etienne and Dawei Fukuma and some others who follow suit of Goethe, comparative literature has expanded its domain from Eurocentrism, gradually to Westcentrism, along with the rise of the American school, headed by Werner Willeck and Henry B. Mack, and finally, to East-West comparative studies of literature. So in this way, we could find world literature has already changed its Eurocentric sense and enlarged its domain to cover literary works of the whole world. So that's possible, for us to use the term. Global literature is now a real global. It's different, which is different from international. And when we talk about global literature, we know the globe is round. It does not only focus on a certain area, literary works, but also on the whole world.
Which also perhaps presupposes the existence of global languages. When a number of British linguists in the 30s were inventing something they called basic English, you may have heard of this. They even translated passages of Finnegan's Wake into basic English. They had the idea that there were only two universal languages, English and Chinese. And so they saw, in a sort of bold anticipation, the 21st century moving towards the interaction between those two languages that are supra-languages, as it were, because they have, for a long time, been used by various groups that have local dialects and that then use another kind of English or Chinese.
Yes, when you mentioned basic English, it also reminds me of I. Richards, who popularized basic English in both America and also Britain based on his knowledge of Chinese. Richards studied some Chinese when he was already well known and taught at Tsinghua University, which helped promote comparative literature in China. And then he went back to the West and to promote classical Chinese culture such as Confucius Analects and Mencius to the whole world. So in this way, it also gives us some inspirations that English and Chinese as two of the most popular lingua francas in the whole world have also changed their own forms. That is, from one English into different Englishes. The post-colonial series used the small lettered English. So I would rather use the English in its plural form. That is from global world English into global Englishes. The same is true of Chinese. Chinese is undergoing a kind of splitting from Mandarin Chinese into different Chinese. As far as we know, Chinese has a lot of dialects, some of which cannot even communicate among each other. Often there's people from Beijing and do not understand what people from Guangdong, when they speak Cantonese, and even they speak Shanghai dialects. So nowadays, the problem is Chinese has only one transcript. Mm. But by and by, you know, we have already noticed some young people in Hong Kong and have also created some words which are not even understood by people in Hong Kong. Mm. And in Taiwan, there are two tendencies. On the one hand, some internationally, you know, far-sighted intellectuals try to globalize, you know, traditional Chinese culture. On the other hand, there is the so-called de-Sinicize Taiwan culture and literature by creating a kind of Taiwanese. So on the other hand, we could find in some overseas Chinese communities, there are also kinds of dialects which are almost different Chineses. Mm-hmm. For instance, people who live in North America speak a different Chinese. We are mixed up with a lot of English terms and some created terms. So in the near future, I'm sure, along with the popularization of the Chinese language, Chinese will also become splitting. Mm-hmm. Yes, many different Chineses will also coexist. Mm-hmm. It's both a good thing as well as a bad thing. The good thing is English Chinese will become a real international language, international lingua franca. On the other hand, some of the essentials of Chinese will be lost in this process. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it will help to promote Chinese culture and literature in the whole world.
But how does that fit with the issue that you develop in, I mean, these two wonderful books? I have to show them. I know people who listen to us can't see them. Translation, Globalization and Localization, Globalization and Cultural Translation. You mention a topic that most of us are interested in, which is that of translation studies and the theory of translation. Isn't there the danger of a loss of, say, the literary distinction or the style in some cases? If you talk about, say, very particular authors who come from a particular region, would there be a loss somehow?
Yes, sure. So that's why we should say, the fact that a Chinese art moving toward the world is much ahead of the Chinese literature moving toward the world, because people could understand art. Mm. People could not understand literature until they understand the language. On the other hand, we could also find translation is a kind of rewriting. Translation is also a kind of betrayal. According to Lawrence Vanuti, who lives also in Philly, said, let's just reduce the betrayal as much as possible. So he put forward two strategies. One is domesticating, the other one is foreignization. So in order to hit the source, language market, we should use the so-called domesticating and policy. On the other hand, in order to resist the colonial hegemonic power of language, we should use the strategy of foreignization. But for Chinese scholars to promote Chinese culture and literature, if we use the foreignizing policy, we could not get the effect. So we should lose something in rendering the essence of Chinese culture and literature. Yes, I give you two examples. One is the very popular translation of Hong Le Meng done by David Hawkes, entitled The Story of the Stone, which hit the market of the English-speaking world. And we could find the version even in the bookstore of the airport. But on the other hand, the faithful, you know, rendition of Honglo Meng into A Dream of Red Mansion by Yang Xingyi and his wife Gladys Yang had very little readership. Although we should say their linguistic speaking, it is more faithful than David Hawkes. But on the other hand, culturally speaking, we should say David Hawkes' version is more successful because it has grasped the reading public and it has reached the book market of the English-speaking country. But Yang's version is only consulted by some professional translation scholars or just some East Asian studies students and faculty members who just check about the translation. So in this way, we should say it's a necessary loss in translating, you know, one's one literature into another language.
Do you think the trend, I guess trend, of Neo-Confucianism that seems to be percolating through China right now, does that connect in any way? Is that a backlash against some of this global literary impulse that you're talking about? Or does it connect with it as well and help in terms of the promotion of the literature to a larger market, to a larger readership?
Yes, I think so. You know, to deal with Confucianism, there are also two attitudes. One is to return to, Confucius himself, which is absolutely impossible. We know Confucius, when he was alive, never published anything at the time. Even there is no way of publishing things. All Confucius' works were edited and, interpreted by his disciples or students. We should say, if we say there are different interpreters, there are different Confucius. On the other hand, it's impossible, yes, to return to real Confucius. On the other hand, we could also find some overseas Chinese, especially in East Asian areas, such as in Singapore, Malaysia, and also in North America, such as Lu Weiming, Chen Zhongying, who tried to reinterpret Confucianism, yes, from a Western point of view. So in this way, new Confucianism has been born as a metamorphosed version against the hegemonic discourse of Western modernity. Yes, according to new Confucianism, the feudal hierarchy has been thrown out, and it is closer to contemporary humanistic concern, and also a kind of postmodern ethic of both end, but not just either or. So in this way, it is closest to postmodernity.
Interesting. Yeah. What about the so-called red classics and their reintroduction in some sense into the canon in a new way? How do you see them in terms of this global literature?
I think perhaps when we talk about red classics, yes, we usually refer to those literary works created under the influence of Chairman Mao's Yan'an Talk. Or even sometimes before that time, because at the time some writers such as Mao Dun, Lu Xun were already influenced by Soviet literary doctrine and Leninist Marxist doctrine. And also after the founding of the PRC in the 1950s and 1960s, we had another canonical body of red classic literary works such as Zhou Libo's Bao Feng Zhou Yu, Liu Qing's works and Ding Ling's works, and so much and so forth. Of course, from a literary point of view, or from an artistic aesthetic point of view, we should say these red classics are not of high value or quality. But on the other hand, as a historical record, Yes, they should be canonical. Through reading of which we could at least know a historical moment in which literary works was produced and literary studies were conducted. So in this way, yes, read classics are still worth, at least worth reading and studying and research.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And you include them in your periodization, I think, of Chinese literature.
Yeah.
You include them as part of the modern period?
Yeah, modern period. Because at the time, we may find read classics already formed in the 1930s and 1940s. If we say starting from Lu Xun, Mao Dun, and through Zhao Shouli, and also after Fang, 1949, it had its own tradition.
Mm.
At first, it's on the periphery, and finally, it occupies the mainstream. And until the end of the Cultural Revolution, when economic reform and opening up to the outside world were practiced in China. So literary creation tried to recover, first for realism, and then to bring about modernism, and then postmodernism. So Chinese literature is closer to world literature and far away from its old revolutionary tradition. We call it in the post-revolutionary era.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I have the impression that what you're suggesting is that in terms of translation studies, the time is ripe for something that will come from China that could be described as Derrida would say in terms of hospitality, that is accepting the foreigner, the foreign, and transforming it. Because this is my question here. Reading your wonderful essays, I think you demonstrate that one needs always a certain practice of translation and a theory of translation, and they go hand in hand. But to give you one example, which I think you know, the way Tagore, who was the first Nobel Prize, who was not a Westerner, but he had been translated by Yeats. And Yeats was not only a great poet, but an Irish nationalist, and he saw a certain link between Bengal and Ireland, and this is why he was attracted to Tagore in the first place. So this generated the success of Tagore's translations into English and the Nobel Prize. Is this situation possible now, from what you can see in China?
I think we also had some successful examples, especially in Gao Xingjian. You know, Gao Xingjian won the Nobel Prize for literature in the year 2000.
Yes.
He was fortunate enough to have such a wonderful translator as Mabel Lee. But many of Gao's contemporaries were unfortunate not to have met such wonderful translators. They still remain marginal or dead, so that's why they were not convinced of Gao's prize winning. They said, well, Gao Xingjian is not the best Chinese writer in the contemporary era, but why he should be awarded the Nobel Prize for literature. As for this, I was also interviewed by a journalist of Asia Weekly. I said, in literary competition, we don't have 1 + 1 = 2. Yes, unlike, you know, physical sports.
Yeah.
We should say Gao Xingjian is one of the best, you know, writers in the Chinese language, although he has already become a French citizen.
Right.
He's among, maybe there are 50 best Chinese writers. Gao definitely belongs to one of them. The same is true of Yu Hua and Mo Yan, whose works have largely been translated into the major Western languages, especially into English. Mm-hmm. So in this way, they cooperated very well with the sinologists. And they even help them to understand their works and to mediate between two languages and cultures. So I'm sure, along with the understanding of their works, they will become more and more popular in the English-speaking world. Mm-hmm. And maybe in the future, they will be awarded a Nobel Prize mm-hmm. for literature. Yes, but unfortunately, they themselves, unlike Tagore, who could also translate his own works or rewrite in the English language in collaboration with Yeats, but they could not do that. They could only depend on translation.
Huh. Yeah. Do you think that it is very important today to translate not only literary works but theory, what we call theory in general, into Chinese? Or conversely, Chinese theory into English?
Yes, I think it's necessary for both. Actually, yes, we have translated almost all the modern and postmodern Western theories into China. We could say sometimes, for instance, when Derrida came to China to lecture in Chinese universities, the Chinese version was published long before the French version and even the English version, because the Chinese presses are interested in publishing as many Western theories as possible. Mm-hmm. Mm. And the Chinese readers are very tolerant toward even the bad translations. Okay. If they don't understand the translated versions, they could say, maybe it's my fault, I don't understand them. They should not say that the translation is bad. But on the other hand, we could also find among Western audience, they are not tolerated at all. If they read the Chinglish, they would say, it's not idiomatic, so we don't read it.
How do you account for that? Why is there such a tolerance for bad translation, as you put it, and also, I guess, not fully understanding, but perhaps filling in or projecting onto the text a meaning on the Chinese side, as opposed to on the English side?
Because they want to know as much as possible from the West. So that's why some green hands just translated. Some of my students, whose English level I know is very low. But they said, they argued that I have translated a book into Chinese. I said, well, it must be full of mistakes.
Mistakes,
and then he said, yes, it has already been published. I said, well, I will write to the publisher to stop it. And then I said, to judge whether one's English is good or bad does not depend on whether he has translated the English into his mother tongue, but to judge whether he could write, could speak, communicate in the English language in an idiomatic way. If not, his English is not so good.
I wonder if there's a timeline involved here. I mean, Jean-Michel was saying before about French English translations of French theory, and initially they were bad, and then got better.
They got better.
So perhaps there's this same trajectory in the works for Chinese, for translations.
Yeah, but maybe I think the cases are different. Although, for instance, the English translation of Jacques Derrida's work is not so good. It is of certain mistakes. Mm. The English language is still somewhat idiomatic, because the publisher, the editors, must have polished that until it is shine. But speaking of the Chinese translations, the publisher usually don't polish it, because they don't understand English. They cannot do that. So that's why some bad translated works were published. Sometimes even the Chinese is very awkward. We could not even understand when we read in Chinese. But when we read in English, we could find, it's easy. It's very clear. So that's...
I was struck by that when I visited that art area what was it called when I was in Beijing,
the
area.
Yeah, 789.
Yeah, 789. They had English translations under some of the art.
Yeah.
And it looked, it was complete gibberish.
Yeah, sure.
Complete. And I just wondered why there was no one around to edit, to get this, you know, just to make sure that the syntax was correct.
Sometimes they also argue that we have had a native speaker to Polish it. I said, well, you know, I have a friend who is also a boss of the art gallery. He asked me to check against the translation. I said, it's full of mistakes. It's useless. And then she said, well, I had a native speaker to check out. I said, perhaps that one just a quick glance over, because he could understand it, so he did not polish it.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Well, as interesting. We know, translation requires time, competence, and generally money as well. But to return to your initial mention of Marx and Engels, I too am always struck by the fact that the best this description of globalization is in the Communist Manifesto. And I think it's still valid for today. But at the same time, we should not forget that it was a manifesto and that Marx and Engels were trying to promote something like a revolution, which they did here and there. Whereas if we think of literature as globalized, don't we see that in many cases, literature is in a way against the general run of things, against the tendency towards universalization, or at times comes from very marginal, minor little enclaves, like, you know, I was talking about Ireland, very tiny country, 4 million inhabitants, Belgium, those tiny countries that produced amazing writers. Slovenia, and so on. We could go on through the list of the explosion of the former Yugoslavia that has produced so much talent because there's been so much violence and blood and so on. So isn't there something that is anti-globalization there?
Yes, we could also find, because I think there are some misunderstandings or different understandings of globalization. I think globalization has brought up two aspects. One is, especially in culture, one is the culture homogenization. Yes, cultures have become more and more homogenized. And then we could find McDonald's, Hollywood in China, and we could also eat in the Chinese restaurant in North America. But on the other hand, we have already noticed these so-called homogenization have already been developed in a diversified way. So on the other hand, we could say globalization has also brought about cultural diversity. And cultural diversity is more and more conspicuous in the process of globalization in culture. And we could also find, yes, when we talk about global literature, another term of world literature, we don't necessarily mean that there is only one literature in the world, but it is of the following significance. The first one is what we refer to global literature simply means, yes, we have yes, a canonical body of literatures from different countries. So it's canonical. It's the best works selected from different countries, different languages. The second one is global literature or world literature has provided us with a unique, broad, you know, perspective from which we could evaluate our own literature. The third one is you know, when we talk about global literature or world literature, it simply means that it has offered us a unique mode of reading. That means, according to David Damrosch, we read it in a distant way. is how the literary works are produced and translated and circulated. In this way, yes, we know when we talk about global literature, we don't necessarily mean that we should produce only one literature, but it must consider two facts, both universalization. The other one is relativity. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think a history of world a literature will be full of European literary works. The works of minor countries and minor literatures can never become canonical, can never become part of world literature. Yes,
You speak about the canonical, diversified canonical literature, but what about the bridging of high and low and the incorporation of popular culture into the dispersal of the canon and the acknowledgement of popular culture? Is that something that's happening in China, and what's your view of that?
Yes, I think, canon formation is not always fixed. Canon should also subject to reformation in different, periods of time and in different regions. Some canonical works maybe in the West should not necessarily be canonical work in the Chinese context. Some canonical Chinese literary works should not be necessarily canonical works in the Western context, largely depending on the receiving context and receptive mind and the reading public. So in this way, yes, we should say canonical works could become popular if we just promote it in a popular way, such as the Chinese translation of Ulysses. It's a very successful example.
You can't say that it's popular, though.
We should say popular. It is sold in almost all the major bookstores.
I know you said it sold 300,000 copies. Is that popular?
Three hundred thousand copies of Ulysses in Chinese were sold out in three different versions.
It just boggles the mind.
Some of my students who do not understand the Ulysses have also bought a copy of Ulysses to put them on the bookshelf to show, I even read the Ulysses. How intelligent I am.
But this is such an interesting turn on the notion of popular. I mean, here what you're talking about really is the popularization of high culture and of a foreign high culture, which is being translated, not understood for the most part. Would you say that most of the 300,000 people who have bought those copies, how many do you think understand or read the book?
But on the other hand, we could find on some websites, such as Google and Baidu, there are summaries of the plot of Ulysses. And a lot of students just read it.
But that's the spark.
They could tell the story. And also there is
a shortened
version
of each chapter.
Yes, of Ulysses. Also published by a bridge one. And in simplified Chinese. So people just know, just like I think Shakespeare's stories by Charles Lamb, which is also very popular.
So Ulysses has entered the culture as the idea of Ulysses has entered the culture, not the book itself.
No.
And in that sense, though, it is certainly, has it had an effect on the culture?
Yes, I could even mention one typical example in a very well-known Chinese writer, Wang Meng, who said many years ago, among today's Chinese writers, we do not necessarily read works written by Rambo Sartre or Sigmund Freud, but still, we could apply their doctrines to our literary creation. That means that there are many ways to know about their adoption. For instance, at the time, I wrote some introductory articles about Freud, and my friend wrote something about Rambo Sartre. And then these writers should just read our introductory articles, and then they know, oh, Freud. Mm. Freud's ideas are composed of libido, Oedipus complex, stream of consciousness, art and the neuroses, and so much and so forth. And they immediately apply in their own writings. So we could find some metamorphosed versions of Freudianism and Sartre's existentialism.
But this is how culture often functions. Mm. There is a good French book translated also into English by Bayard, How to Talk About the Books
You Haven't Read. Yeah, I love that.
And he demonstrates that in many, many cases, at least in France, famous literary figures would praise each other without having read the other's books, but would, of course, disguise it. But it's not so negative. First, they had vaguely heard of something, and then, as you say, some notions which may be misunderstood, superego or the id, will then continue working through a certain culture at a given time, even if most of the people who use them will not have read Freud. I think this was the case of what was called Freudianism in the US in the 1950s. It was nobody had read Freud. They had read bolderized, Americanized versions of Freud in which the sexual content was toned down.
Or they'd watched Hitchcock Spellbound.
Yeah, exactly. And then Hitchcock took over. But nevertheless, there was a certain impact without people having actually read the text.
No? Yeah, actually, it's the same of true of Marxism in China. Marxism in China is synthesized. Chinese scholars of Marxism do not necessarily read the original of Marx and Engels. They would rather read Mao Zedong's, Lenin Stalin's simplified or synthesized Marxist works. So that's the problem. So that's why we often say synthesized certain things, synthesized Marx and synthesized Shakespeare and synthesized Henrik Ibsen, so much and so forth. And we could ask, one of my students has written his dissertation on James Joyce in China, and in which he tries to define how James Joyce became popular among ordinary readers. And of course, there are certain ways of promoting it. Long before the official publication of Ulysses, the journal 世界文学, World Literature published some introductory and critical articles about James Joyce and Ulysses, accusing him as a decadent bourgeois, modernist writer, and accusing the novel Ulysses is full of meaningless stream of consciousness descriptions centering on sex, so much and so forth. So a lot of people just expected to read the complete versions. And then, on the other hand, even before the publication, there was a competition of two versions. One was done by the James Joyce scholar, Jing Di, who had a good foundation of translation and who had deep knowledge of James Joyce. So he translated very slowly. But the press is the top press, the people's literature press. So ordinary people did think that no one could compete with him. But actually, there is someone to compete with him. That is a local press, which is called the Yiling Press, and which was a newly rising local press in Nanjing. And the boss of the press knew clearly. He used to study economics in Renmin University of China. He knew that if we just invited a very famous journalist to translate the book, it must be very popular. So they did. They invited Mr. Xiao Qian, who was a well-known writer, a well-known journalist, much more famous than Jing Di. And before his completion of the translation, the press also organized some critical articles published in newspapers. So all the readers had already been very anxious to have the version. So I was told by the press, when Xiao Qian translated with his wife, Ulysses, he sent page by page yes, to the press. And at the time, they did not use computer. And as soon as the press received the faxed page, they just immediately type. Yes. So before Jing Di completed his version, yes, Xiao's version had already been published and printed in 100,000 copies. But
what,
even
what
so,
year, what year was that?
But even so, Jing's version was still printed in 50,000 copies. Because people just checked. So, for instance, I have got two copies. One is sent by the press. The other one, I bought a copy of Jing's version. I knew Jing was a very serious translator. His version must be very faithful. So I bought the copy.
Was the article that you described that called James Joyce a decadent writer, was that the precipitating factor in your view for the popularity?
Sometimes in China, Chinese peoples are famous for you know, commerce psychology.
Yeah.
And if you criticize him as much as possible, people would like to read it. The year before last, when Salinger died, Salinger's short novel, Catcher in the Rye, became popular again.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of TV stations interviewed some scholars of foreign literature. I was also interviewed by Beijing TV station. But at the time, I said, well, I already on the taxi. I will go to Shanghai. Would you please interview some other scholars? Yes. And then, even on the death of Jacques Derrida, Derrida's books were reprinted again.
Mm.
Yeah. Yes, I should say, I was inspired by the American sinologist Eric Derlich, because he talked a lot about the post-revolutionary period, and then I used the post-revolutionary aura in one of his books in Chinese. So I edited and translated for him. Yes, I also developed the idea, in my opinion, in the reform era, the main trend is not a revolution, but commercialization and also economic construction. So in this way, literary works are written not for calling on people's struggle against the bourgeois ideology, but rather to encourage people to have a better life. On the other hand, we could find even a lot of revolutionary things are consumerized. Even the so-called red classic works were adapted and revised in a pragmatic way. And even some red areas, such as Jinggang San, Lu San, are used for consumer tourism.
Mm.
So in this way, we should say a revolutionary period has become a post-revolutionary period. And in the post-revolutionary period, the massive class struggle has stopped.
Hmm.
And the people just work for a better life in whatever means possible. So in this way, we could also find some corruption and also ecological exhaustion, the the exhaustion of natural resources, and so much and so forth. Yes, so that is what happened in post-revolutionary period. Yeah. And we should also say literary writing has also been degraded. I think in the previous period, for instance, the so-called New Period, writers wrote largely for either for life's sake or for art's sake. But in the post-revolutionary period, writers just write for market, for money, or for, you know, popularization, and not for artistic sake. And some writers even boast, yes, in the past 3 months, I have completed one novel. They are proud of themselves to completing one novel within 3 months. They do not, follow suit of Ernest Hemingway, who completed his short novel, The Old Man and the Sea, by revising it for 39 times.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't do that. You know, I once heard a novelist said, I never revise my novel. I just finished at one blow, and then put in press.
One last question.
We have a colleague here at Slot Foundation, Emily Apter, has been compiling an encyclopedia of untranslatable concepts. Is there such a thing for you as an untranslatable?
Yeah, something is untranslatable. But even so, for serious translators, something untranslatable could be translated by, I think, free translators, because they could throw the original away by create what he himself think about that, just like the old Chinese translator Lin Su, who did not understand a foreign language, but who translated about 100 Western novels or short stories from English, French, and German. Finally, people found that he had more than 10 collaborators. For instance, I just tell the story to him, and then he used idiomatic French to rewrite it. So as far as the story is concerned, it's faithful. But as far as detailed description is concerned, is unfaithful. So that is the case. So to serious translators, something is really untranslatable. For instance, James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake is untranslatable. Mm. If you just want to translate it, you should be, you know, a traitor. But the only thing is we should try to betray the original as little as possible. I think that is the correct attitude of a translator.
Yeah, thank you very much, Professor Wang. You translated a lot for us tonight.
Thank you very much.
A wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.